I'm Dan Webster, film critic for Spokane Public Radio and blogger for Spokane7.com.
And I'm Mary Pat Truthart, part-time film critic, full-time law professor at Gonzaga University School of Law.
And I'm Nathan Weinbender, also a film critic for Spokane Public Radio.
And welcome to Movies 101, the show that has a distinctive style, though we'd have to admit that it's evolved over the years. That said, Nathan, our resident Dorian Gray, strangely enough, never seems to age. Anyway, recognizable style is on our docket this week as we contemplate new movies by two popular filmmakers. The first is The French Dispatch, the latest release by Wes Anderson. Following that, we'll discuss Last Night in Soho, a change of pace for English director Edgar Wright. Let's begin this week's show by turning the pages on Wes Anderson's love letter to magazine journalism. It's tempting to say that if you've seen one Anderson movie, you've seen them all, but that would be unfair. The Royal Tenenbaums is as different from Fantastic Mr. Fox as the Darjeeling Limited is from Isle of Dogs. Still, it's not hard to find similar themes as well as stylistic techniques and casting choices among the dozen or so features that Anderson has directed over the past 25 years. His latest effort, The French Dispatch, bears all the standard Anderson stylisms, precisely framed set pieces, quirky self-referential dialogue, a storyline that is imaginative and reflective both of personal foibles and overall cultural consciousness. The standard players are present too, most notably Bill Murray and Owen Wilson, along with some flavors of the moment. Hello, Timothy Chalamet. What's somewhat different is Anderson's plot, which is nothing less than an adoring look at magazine journalism of the near past. In particular, Anderson explores the publication edition of an English language produced in France, New Yorker-style magazine, which bears the same name as the film itself. He does so through an examination of individual stories as narrated by the likes of characters played by Wilson, Tilda Swinton, Jeffrey Wright, and Francis McDormand. It's all perfectly rendered, with a bittersweetly funny tone, another Anderson trait, that may leave you feeling a bit nostalgic, but at least for some of us, also fully entertained.
Yeah, the main complaint I've seen about The French Dispatch from the folks that don't like it is that Anderson has been here before, that he's trod this territory in other movies, and he is maybe the most recognizable, at least stylistically, filmmaker working right now. You can look at a Wes Anderson shot and know that Wes Anderson was the guy behind the camera when that shot was put together. And as you mentioned, Dan, you can see all of his quirks, all of his pet themes, all of the ways that he likes to play around with the frame and how he puts people usually in the dead center of the frame. I mean, that's all here. And I guess if you're kind of tired of that style, maybe this movie will seem tiring for you because it's, even though it's, I think, less than 2 hours, it's a lot of movie. There are so many Wes Anderson shots crammed into this film. So if you're growing tired of that, you'll probably find this tiresome. But I am not tired of that style, and I loved this movie. I was just in awe of it from frame one to the final frame. And I was just sitting in the theater so grateful that somebody had made a movie. And this is going to sound kind of weird, and I think we'll be talking about it in the second half when we talk about Edgar Wright. But I was so grateful that the person that made this movie cared about the movie that they were making. This feels like Wes Anderson put so much thought, and his crew, and it's all of his regular players, not just the actors, but the crew has come back. It really feels like they put care and effort into every inch of the frame. I mean, there are shots in this movie, in The French Dispatch, that are like a Jacques Tati movie, where he'll just have a tableau on the frame, in the frame, and then the actors will kind of interact with it. There's, near the very beginning of the movie, this, it feels like something right out of Playtime, the Jacques Tati movie, where we see a guy delivering groceries through this elaborate M.C. Escher-style building, and we watch as he goes through one door and out another, and up a stairwell, and then through a dumbwaiter, and it's just, I mean, I can see how that could be whimsy overload for some people, but I was just delighted by the entire thing, and my eyes just kept darting around the frame, trying to find all the little details and the hidden Easter eggs. And then beyond that, I think there is actually some heart to this film, despite the fact that everyone is kind of deadpan and poker face the way that they are in Wes Anderson movies. And I think that what he's saying about the artistry that goes into this kind of journalism, you can tell that he really loves this. And at the end, he calls out all of the old school New Yorker columnists that inspired the
movie.
And
editors, yes.
And I also love the fact that each of these three, because it's kind of a triptych as far as the story construction is concerned, and these three chapters, they all kind of follow the same framework where you have a journalist that gets emotionally involved in their subjects in a way that's maybe ethically iffy, and then how they have to kind of structure that into the story. And all three stories end with some kind of skirmish or a shootout with police, or there's even a scene involving some poisoned turnips that, that comes
all
into
which
play.
Are brilliantly staged.
Yes, and there's animation and stop motion, and it's just it's like a mixed media collage of a movie, and I was just enthralled by it. And I can understand why this movie might rub people the wrong way. And maybe it was just the feeling I had that day, but I walked out of this movie just excited to go to the movies again and to see it on a big screen. And this is one of my favorite Wes Anderson movies. It's one of my favorite movies of the year. I was over the moon for this one.
And I feel similarly. I think that the only thing that was a little off-putting to me was in the very first story, Benicio del Toro, who I actually think probably gave the best performance of anyone.
I would say Jeffrey Wright.
In this film. Well, yeah, except the sort of James Baldwin comparisons were a little bit maybe too much there. So, but Benicio del Toro is this individual who is imprisoned, and I'm not sure that they needed to make him into like a psychopath. I think that that sort of detracted in some ways from who he was and,
but he
and
says
why he was there.
You cut off the two bartenders' heads with hacksaws, and he says, well, the first one was an accident, and the self one was self-defense. The second one was self-defense.
So, but I actually think in some ways that might have been the most enthralling story because it involves this guy who's imprisoned in France and his relationship with the female prison guard who's watching over him. And then it's linked back to a museum in the middle of Kansas. And Tilda Swinton is
another good performance.
Yeah, is sort of talking about the art of this imprisoned guy. And so there are all these different pieces and moving parts to it. It's sort of a commentary on visual arts and the value and maybe the overvaluing. But that's the sequence where you see Adrian Brody and you see Lea Seydoux and all of these people show up in that particular
in bit parts. Bob Balaban and Hintron Winkler. I mean,
yes,
you know.
Yes. Yep. So that was probably my favorite sequence. But the other two primary sequences, I mean, how can you go wrong if you have Frances McDormand in something? I'm not sure that Timothée Chalamet was perfectly cast. He was either perfectly cast or not. I'm not sure. But that's a story about French revolutionaries, student revolutionaries, based on what happened in 1968. And Frances McDormand is sort of reporting on this, and then she becomes involved and, you know, so forth and so on. And I think that the French-Algerian woman who's starring opposite Timothée Chalamet is getting a lot of, is her name Cordry? Anna Cordry, getting a lot of sort of attention, I think, for her role. And then finally, we have the sort of last one, which is in some ways the most improbable sort of food critic situation that you can imagine, because it involves a chef who's cooking for the police commissioner and cooking for the police. And so it doesn't seem that it would work at all. It seems bizarre and strange. But then when you have Jeffrey Wright and Liev Schreiber and Steve Park and all of these people in it, it just works. The story somehow works. But Nathan, you focused on the most important thing about this film. It is beautiful. I mean, you could take a screenshot of any frame, and there's so much happening.
Yep.
There's so
every
much
frame
going
of painting.
On. Yeah, everything is absolutely beautiful, and it's smart. It expects us to catch up, and then if you don't quite get it, that's okay too.
And it goes along, it snaps along.
It's breakneck.
There are very few moments in The French Dispatch where you're catching your breath. It's always like, what is happening now? So it's rich in its display, and it's rich in theme, and it's rich in content also. The one comment I would make based upon what you were saying, Nathan, about this might be too much for people. Look, I have not been a fan of every single one of Anderson's movies. I mean, Royal Tenenbaums to me was my favorite until I saw this movie. And when I saw the trailer for The French Dispatch several months ago, I went, oh my God, he's just repeating himself. I'm going to hate this movie. And I went in with a negative attitude, and it won me over big time. I totally agree with you. No matter what else opens this year, The French Dispatch will be on my list of top 10 films.
Same
of
here.
2021.
And I think that we should also emphasize how funny this movie is.
Yeah.
I mean, it has some laugh out loud moments.
And bittersweet,
yes,
too.
But there are moments of slapstick that are like, like Buster Keaton style slapstick physical comedy gags. But then you also have kind of the throwaway bon mots that everybody speaks in these movies. And it's like the rat-a-tat 1940s dialogue that's happening and in the scenes in the newspaper office where you have all of these characters, including Elizabeth Moss and Jason Schwartzman and a Fisher Stevens and Griffin Dunn and these people that are only kind of on the periphery of these stories. And it just it feels like there's a bustling world.
By Angelica Houston, which I thought was an excellent choice. But I really do think, I mean, to say that it's clever, because it is really understating all of the brilliance that's associated with The French Dispatch.
Yeah, I look forward to seeing it again because there's so much I missed the first time. Yeah. It'll be great to see it again and catch all that stuff.
And that was our discussion of The French Dispatch. This is Movies 101, and it's time to take a short break. Before we go, remember that you can access podcasts of Movies 101 by going online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. While there, check out the individual reviews that Nathan and I write. Don't do it now, though, because we'll be right back to look at Edgar Wright's Last Night in Soho. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
We say this often because it's an important fact about public radio. Everything you count on from us. Trusted news, in-depth features, conversations, music, and culture depends on your support. In moments of challenge, possibility, and progress, public radio is a sound, trusted source of information. And that means your participation is more necessary and powerful than ever. Please help SPR meet these momentous times with your generous support so we can be there for you today and for generations to come. It's easy and secure. Just click the red donate bar at SpokanePublicRadio.org, fill out a brief form, and emerge a new member. You'll be glad you did whenever you turn on your radio. And thanks.
And we're back. This is Movies 101, and I'm your host, Dan Webster. During the first half of the show, Mary Pat Truthart, Nathan Weinbinder, and I discussed Wes Anderson's film, The French Dispatch. Let's now move to Last Night in Soho, which was directed by Edgar Wright. Though he doesn't have a distinct style in the way that Wes Anderson does, the English filmmaker Wright is known for affecting a certain kind of comic tone. That tone is on particular display in the films that he made with the actor-screenwriter Simon Pegg. I'm thinking, of course, of Shaun of the Dead, Hot Fuzz, and The World's End. More recently, Wright has branched out. His 2017 film Baby Driver was an action thriller, and he directed last year's documentary The Sparks Brothers. And he's continued his filmmaking evolution with Last Night in Soho, a kind of dreamlike time travel mystery that was written by Christy Wilson Cairns. Thomasin McKenzie plays Eloise, a young woman from southwestern England who comes to big city London to study fashion. Following in the footsteps of her mother, for whom the pressure proved too much, Eloise, obsessed with life in the 1960s, finds herself dreaming of the London of that era. In those dreams, though, she finds herself becoming a witness to the life of a young woman named Sandy, played by Anya Taylor-Joy, who is trying to become a singer. Caught between the potential for the mental instability that affected her mother and the paranormal possibility that she is indeed speaking to and for the dead, Eloise, through Wilson Cairns' screenplay, makes a strong Me Too argument that might have been more effective had not the overall film devolved ultimately into a standard kind of murder mystery featuring an overtly grisly Grand Guignol finale.
And I am not one to criticize murder mysteries or murder shows or anything that's murder related. But I have to say, Last Night in Soho did not work for me all the way through. So it caught my attention early on. I thought that Wright starts out really nicely in terms of presenting Eloise's background and how she gets to London and how thrilled she is. Young girl, big city, et cetera, et cetera. But all of those scenes, I really liked the music. I liked the style. A lot of the scenes take place at night or it's a little overcast because after all, it is London. So I liked how that played out. So the first third of the movie, I was with it.
It's brilliant.
We are introduced to all of these different characters. And then Ellie starts switching places with this young woman from the 60s, Sandy. And so some of those scenes were really intriguingly shot, where she would be going up the stairs and then we would see the other person reflected in the mirror.
And I'm pretty sure those were practical effects, because that's kind of Edgar Wright's
thing. Right, exactly, yeah. Exactly. And so then Matt Smith is involved in this portion of the film and so forth. But then we start to realize, something hinky has happened here, and we're not really sure what it is, but we draw our own conclusions, which I do think he handled that well, because we sort of go down a path and then it's like, oh, well, maybe that's not what I thought it was. Now, we also are exposed to Ellie's life as she's trying to become, you know, a designer, clothing designer, and she's going to art school or design school for that purpose. And there's this whole subplot involving these mean girls in her class. And I just didn't really appreciate fully maybe what he was trying to accomplish there. She does find a friend, a kind soul who sort of watches over her, one of her fellow students and so forth. And then there's the whole plot that involves her landlady, who's this super strict older woman, can't have boys back to the bedsit where you're living and so forth and so on. So we have all these different relationships that are happening during two different time periods. And I think it works until it doesn't. And then it just, Dan, as you point out, it got really gruesome and grisly in this sort of, you know, way that
Italian giallo.
Yeah, it really went to this place of gore, and
what's
I thought I was
that?
Watching Halloween. No, if you're going to have a murder show, you got to stay with some conventions. You know, you can't have these ghosts of Christmas past in there.
I think I see what he's doing in this movie in Last Night in Soho, and I think I was more sympathetic to what he was trying to do. This movie has been kind of divisive. I've seen some people that are really on its wavelength, and other people that think it's just totally clumsy and doesn't work. And I think the way that it starts to explore its themes in the back half of the movie is a little clunky. I mean, there's this running theme of the predatory men of the
Correct.
Big city.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
that,
yeah.
That comes into sharper focus the more we know about this plot line that's in the 1960s. And we learn the people in the 1960s, what their identities are in the present day. And of course, you have the landlady, we should notice, played by Diana Rigg, who is Emma Peel from the original Avengers.
Movie, I think.
And it was her last film.
Right.
And it's
and the Red Herring, played by Terrence Stamp.
Yes, Terrence Stamp, who, of course, was in a lot of those the
yes,
movies
yes,
that
yes,
Edgar
was.
Wright is referencing here. And I've seen the giallo comparisons a lot, and I kind of get it, but it's not overtly that. I think it's mostly just the sharp colors and the weird focus that he does sometimes, the very 1960s swinging kind of cinematography that I think people are alluding to. But I was mostly into this movie. I agree with you that, like Baby Driver, the first half is much stronger than the second half. I didn't mind the descent into insane violence at the end, because I assumed that's where it was heading anyway. I think if the movie does have a problem, it's the middle section, which I think really drags and is very repetitive. I mean, how many times do we see Thomas and Mackenzie like fall down and hit her head and she's not sure where
that
she
happened.
Is and something comes out from behind a bookshelf or something
and
startles
her.
Yeah,
her
just over and over
and
over again.
And the character of Michael Ahau, the guy who befriends her, I mean, his character ends up being really nothing. It's just a placeholder.
Basically, yeah, it's sort of a nothing character, unfortunately. I
well,
like that
I think
actor.
It's trying to make these larger statements about gender and gender politics and violence against
and
women.
And how that's changed or hasn't changed over time.
And all of those
and
things.
And commenting on race by not commenting on race.
Right, right. And so I think that this film, to me, missed the mark or missed an opportunity. And then, of course, he has to throw in a twist, which was not really that
surprising. Yeah.
But I liked the way that it was filmed in terms of the chiaroscuro, the sort of dark and light. And the dance scenes were amazing. I mean, they were so energizing.
Yeah. I think the really problem for me was that first third was so strong, I thought, this is incredible. I mean, what he's doing here, I have no idea where he's going, but I think I'm going to like this. And then it just became a standard movie, you know, and it was like, oh, and I was let down.
I don't think that standard is the right word, because we see so much homogenous junk on the movie beat. And this is not homogenous. And it feels like, again, I mentioned this in the first half when we talked about The French Dispatch, but looking at Last Night in Soho, again, I was grateful to see a movie by a capital F filmmaker who was clearly having a lot of fun making this movie and putting in the visual allusions to the stuff that he loves. And I mean, on a purely sensory level, because sometimes you just want to go to a movie to have a sensory experience and nothing else. I think this movie, Last Night in Soho, works best on that level. I mean, just the fashions and the music and the looks of 1960s London are perfectly captured.
The art design, the set design, all of those things are great.
The soundtrack is
just the content. Yeah, it was the content that was the problem. No.
I think the content is better than you're giving it.
Well, I guess my problem in the end was, what do we know about either Eloise or Sandy? I mean, they become sort of caricatures, you know, like the wide-eyed knave in, you know, London, the woman who was, I guess, subjected to abuse in this, you know, I don't know.
That Ellie character is... She's almost like comically helpless.
It's like that Emily in Paris.
Sure. I haven't seen it, but I'm sure it's just like that.
Right. It's exactly like that.
Yeah. Well, that was our discussion of Last Night in Soho by Edgar Wright.
Sort of a mixed reaction to that.
I liked it.
Mary Pat wants to tell us something about a film event that is happening Saturday night at the Magic Lantern.
Yeah, so we are fortunate because on November 6th at 6:30, so Saturday, we are going to have the opportunity to attend a free event called SBFF, and that's based on the Seattle Black Film Festival, and it's going to be a series of shorts, so it's SBFF Remix, and there will be people there from the film festival who will answer questions, talk about the organization, and I think that the highlight of this particular festival is the fact that it really is focused on storytelling by Black filmmakers, creators, and participants.
And by the way, that sponsoring organization is the Langston Hughes Performing Art Institute of Seattle. So
Saturday, November 6th, 6:30, Magic Lantern, free. Doors open at 6.
And with that, we come to an end of Movies 101. I'm Dan Webster, and early in the show, Nathan Weinbender, and Mary Pat Truthart and I discuss Wes Anderson's The French Dispatch and Edgar Wright's Last Night in Soho. Let's take this moment to thank Peter Glarberg for both producing and engineering the show, and we thank you to our loyal listeners. We invite you back next week, same time, same spot, on the radio dial, when we'll again check out all the best that cinema has to offer, wherever we can find it. Until then, remember these words from the director David Fincher. If you think that you can hide what your interests are, what your prurient interests are, what your noble interests are, what your fascinations are, if you think you can hide that in your work as a film director, you're nuts. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
The Movies 101 podcast is made possible by the members of Spokane Public Radio. Become a member at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thanks for listening to Movies 101.